John, thank you for leading us tonight. I love the cello. I'm actually jealous. I wish I did play the cello. The cello sounds good with everything, especially with piano, but I think you could play the kazoo and the cello together, and it would be delightful. One of my favorite instruments by a landslide. I invite you to open your Bible to Psalm 39 tonight. We were served very well by Phil Johnson this morning as he led us through God's omnipotent power in the life of a man who considered himself ultimately powerful and was shown otherwise by the sovereign hand of God. And an epic message, really, to remind us all of the sovereignty of God over all things, especially in the realm of salvation, able to convert and drastically save. Tonight, we begin our summer series. It's going to be a series of messages that our dear pastor asked us to undertake about eschatology. Now, eschatology is a fancy word, but not too fancy. It simply means the study of last things. Eschatology is to talk about the end times, the return of Christ, the millennial kingdom, heaven and hell, judgment and rewards. And that's what's in store for us on Sunday nights this summer, as we have a litany of guys on staff at church that are going to approach topics pertaining to end times, to the final things, to the consummation of this world order, and to bring about God's appointed ends. Some of these messages will come from the book of Revelation, obviously, and we'll see messages from all over Scripture because God revealed his plan for the end starting in the very beginning, as he promised that Jesus Christ would come in Genesis 3 and crush the opposition. And tonight, as I thought about how would it be most helpful to introduce a series about the end times, how do we seek to answer the question, why is this so important? Why is it worthy of your attention and your time on Sunday nights? Why is this a pressing matter? I don't think it's because this church is confused about eschatology. I think we have a very clear position that we call premillennialism that is what we believe the Bible articulates, and we've held to that unswervingly over the years. Our pastor has preached through Revelation not just one time, but a number of times. In the 10 years I've been at this church, he's done a jet tour of Revelation more than once. He's helpfully led us through questions and answer sessions about eschatology. So why does it matter? And as I started to think about why this would be helpful for our church and how I could set us up this summer for a series on eschatology, I was mindful of those who might feel like maybe they have all their eschatology figured out. Or I was also mindful of, I've talked to folks, I'm thinking of a man in particular who told me that he was a pan-millennialist, not an amillennialist, not a post-millennialist, not a pre-millennialist, but a pan-millennialist. He said that that means that he believes that all things will just pan out in the end. So, you know, it's kind of a tired joke, but it's one that expresses a sort of indifference towards eschatology. And so I thought, why don't we start with something from the Old Testament? Why don't we start with a passage of Scripture that I've wanted to investigate for quite some time, wanted to look into, and just to look at and say, why does eschatology matter so much? And in systematic theology, there's an approach to eschatology that's either general eschatology, talking about the aforementioned things, the millennium, the rapture, but there's another category called personal eschatology. And that's where I want to start tonight. It's what happens at your end. What happens when your life draws to a finish, to a close? Because that is eschatology that is deeply personal to every one of us. And it was something that was on King David's mind. In a season of difficulty, either sickness or being plagued by enemies, Whether it was warfare or difficult circumstances, we don't know. He wrote a psalm that's not unique in the Psalter. There's other songs like it. Moses wrote one similarly in Psalm 90. There's chapters in Job that look a lot like Psalm 39. But Psalm 39, I think, is a typical Davidic psalm coming from the first book of the Psalter that teaches us to number our days, teaches us to think about the end of our times. And so I've entitled this message from Psalm 39, "The End of Our Times," thinking about the end of our time. So let's begin by reading Psalm 39. It says, "For the choir director, for Jeduthun, a psalm of David. I said, I will guard my ways that I may not sin with my tongue. I will guard my mouth as with a muzzle while the wicked are in my presence. I was dumb and silent. I refrained even from good, and my sorrow grew worse. My heart was hot within me. While I was musing, the fire burned, and then I spoke with my tongue. Lord, make me to know my end, and what is the extent of my days? Let me know how transient I am. Behold, thou hast made my days as handbreadths, and my lifetime is nothing in thy sight. Surely every man at his best is a mere breath. Surely every man walks about as a phantom. Surely they make an uproar for nothing. He amasses riches and does not know who will gather them. And now, Lord, for what do I wait? My hope is in thee. Deliver me from all my transgressions. Make me not the reproach of the foolish. I have become dumb. I do not open my mouth, because it is thou who hast done it. Remove thy plague from me, because of the opposition of thy hand I am perishing. With reproofs thou dost chasten a man for iniquity. Thou dost consume as a moth what is precious to him. Surely every man is a mere breath. Selah. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear to my cry. Do not be silent at my tears, for I am a stranger with thee, a sojourner like all my fathers. Turn thy gaze away from me, that I may smile again before I depart and am no more." Being both a nerd and a sports fan has drawn me to a particular website I like to read called 538.com. It's not a Christian website. In fact, it's a website dedicated to statistics. But it's applied statistics, and as a fan of God's glorious invention of baseball, I appreciate sabermetrics and some of the mathematical side of sports. And that's mostly what's on this website. But the other day, a headline on this website, founded by a premier statistician trying to apply data to elections and sports and flight times and a thousand other things, had an article on there that really grabbed my eye. A title so compelling, I couldn't help but click. The title is this: "Why the Oldest Person in the World Keeps Dying." That's the kind of stuff that draws me in. Before you say, "Duh," and don't worry, we'll end there, let me give you a little taste of this article. Written by David Goldenberg, it says, "As the oldest person in the world, Gertrude Weaver was making the best of her time in the limelight. When I called the 116-year-old Arkansas resident 2 days into her reign on a Friday in early April, she was resting after a couple of television appearances and a half dozen phone interviews. With the help of her 73-year-old granddaughter, She offered up theories about her longevity, hard work, love God, as her granddaughter put it, and even invited President Obama to her next birthday party. Kathy Langley, the administrator at Silver Oaks Health and Rehabilitation Center, the Camden facility where Weaver was living, estimated that Weaver was getting more than 50 calls a day from media outlets wanting to speak to her. "It's somewhat overwhelming," she said, asking me to call back Monday. And when I did, I learned that Weaver had died that morning. He goes on to write, "Weaver was part of what is perhaps the world's most wizened sorority, one open only to those who are once the oldest living person on earth. And when I looked into everyone who had that distinction, I found that more people than ever are clustering at the outer edge of human aging, and that the tenure of the world's oldest living person isn't as long as it used to be. Better record keeping and longer lifespans have helped lead to quite a crowd." The article goes on to describe Mrs. Weaver's life in particular and those who have occupied the place of the world's oldest person and for how long, and those facts were charted, and it's really quite a fascinating article. One of the little tidbits that I found quite interesting is Mrs. Weaver didn't check into an aging facility until she was 107. Impressive. So supercentenarians, as you know, people who live past their 110th birthday, are quite rare. But we're all aware of the ridiculousness of a headline like this, "Why the oldest person in the world keeps dying," because there is one statistic that you don't have to understand sabermetrics or even a little bit of math to understand, is that every single person keeps dying. It is a universal reality. And it is the reality that is on the mind of David as he composes Psalm 39. He considers life as a breath. And he considers this in the context, not just of philosophy and certainly not of statistics. David thinks of the vanity of life in terms of the difficulty he's presently undergoing. David's present circumstances, being under what he sees as the discipline of God for real sin that he's going to confess in this psalm, leads him to consider in great detail the brevity of human life, the end of his own existence. And I think this is why Psalm 39 leads us towards a compelling interest in a series on eschatology. Because no matter how much you've studied the end times, no matter how much familiarity you have with the book of Revelation or what your understanding of the rapture is in 1 Thessalonians 4, there is a compelling reality that we all have in common and that we're all aware of, and it is this: today we are closer to our own death than we were yesterday, and none of us know how many days we have. Therefore, in light of the difficulties of this life, living in a fallen world, and because of the discipline of God, which I think we also can share and understand in New Covenant realities, along with King David, I think it's wise to look at Psalm 39 as a gateway to a study of eschatology as we think about numbering and considering our own end. So a little bit about Psalm 39 in its context. Psalm 39 is a twin psalm with Psalm 38. They share much similar language. The word burning anger in verse 1, the concept of a hand pressed down in Psalm 38, verse 2 is shared among these two psalms. They both speak of the psalmist's iniquities. They're both psalms of David. Psalm 38 is a psalm that's more fixed and focused on physical affliction, but it goes through thinking about these same concepts and using similar words. Verse 13, he speaks of the deaf man and the dumb man and not opening his mouth and not hearing. And so there is the continuing theme of silence and the theme of speaking and the theme of affliction. And these two psalms begin to wrap up the first book of the Psalter. As you know, the book of Psalms, the longest book in the Bible, is divided into five parts. The first book is traditionally called the Davidic Songs, and most of them are composed by David, and that would be true of Psalm 39. As this book of the Psalter has opened with Psalm 1 standing like a guard at the Psalter, saying that there's only two ways to enter this book, the way of the righteous or the way way of the wicked. Choose which way you'll go, the way of the blessed man or the way of the cursed man. That's the first psalm, and it leads us through, consequently, the rest of this book, all the way up to Psalm 39, a psalm that's considered a psalm of individual lament, a psalm marked by sorrow and seriousness, a psalm that considers that most unpopular topic at dinner parties, the topic of death. This is no Psalm 23. I doubt the familiarity with Psalm 39 is widespread. I had never studied it in depth before this opportunity. It's not a psalm as memorable as others. And in fact, the lines that are memorable in Psalm 39 are found in other places like Job 7 and Psalm 90, Moses' famous song. And scholars have looked at this song and scratched their heads a bit. One calls it an enigmatic piece. A scholar named Mays calls it a strange prayer. Robert Alter wonders, well, about everything, but in this case, he wonders about the psalmist's world of radical ambiguities, as he calls it. Kidner, one of my favorite authors on the Psalms, says the burning question of this psalm is why God should so assiduously discipline the creature as frail and fleeting as man. And there we're getting close to a theme to this song. Some have found in this psalm not an enigmatic piece or a confusing psalm, but a place of great joy and comfort. Some have found a special connection to this song. One student of the Psalms said this, "Read this psalm frequently, and it will bring blessing to heart and life." So it's an interesting song as we've laid it out for us. The famous commentator on the Psalms, the famous Christian pastor, Charles Spurgeon, considers this psalm and says, well, his heart was musing, it was fusing, for the subject was confusing. You didn't know Spurgeon was the forerunner to the modern Christian rapper. He wasn't. But it's an interesting line, isn't it? Well, his heart was musing, it was fusing, for the subject was confusing. David is framing questions, eternal questions, and he's growing in his understanding of God's answer and purposes. And the psalm itself is a prayer to God, a prayer that begins as a complaint and then moves towards a deepened and realized faith. But it never completely resolves itself either. And I think that's why this song is so compelling. It's one that drives us further in prayer. It doesn't wrap itself neatly in a bow. Instead, it leaves us, as life often does, with a series of questions, but an increasing dependence on God in our lives of faith. So how do we look at this song? It's been divided a number of ways. I want to look at it in four parts. Four parts, verses 1-3. We'll look at a silence that bothered, a silence that bothered in verses 1-3. In verses 4-6, we'll see a life that is brief, a life that is brief. The third part is verses 7-11, a silence that's believing. And the fourth part is a life that is boundless, verses 12-13, a silence that is bothered, a life that is brief, a silence that's believing, and a life that is boundless. All of this with the intention of driving us to a deeper desire to think about the end of our days, to realize that this life is quickly passing us by. And when we endeavor to study eschatology, we are studying our own future reality, a reality that will outlast and out experience this present one. And so we enter into this psalm alongside of David, a song written by him in a dark time, given to the choir director, in the style of Jeduthun, one of the Levites in 2 Chronicles, a beautiful poem that's been useful in Christian worship for centuries, an elegant prayer that cries out for help, that has so much in common with so many other passages of Scripture, yet another petition from a sufferer, but adds to its unique contribution a reminder that our time and our days are limited. So let's go with David into this difficulty and see what we can learn. Verse 1 says, I said, I will guard my ways that I may not sin with my tongue. I will guard my mouth as with a muzzle while the wicked are in my presence. Verse 3 has something in common with verse 1. It says, my heart was hot within me while I was musing, the fire burned, then I spoke with my tongue. The word tongue featured in verse 1 and verse 3 forms something in Hebrew poetry called an inclusio. It's simply a bracketing, a way to set out these thoughts. And I want to consider verses 1 through 3 under the heading, a silence that bothered. You see, David was consumed by these burning questions. He was consumed by life's sorrows. And it's reminiscent, his speech about holding his tongue, about guarding his mouth as with a muzzle because of the presence of the wicked. It's reminiscent of Psalm 73. Psalm 73 is more well known. That's the psalm that asks questions about the prosperity of the wicked. And in it, the author Asaph says, I did dare not speak these things in the presence of the generation. He wouldn't say the things that were on his mind in the presence of children. He didn't want to undermine their faith. Similarly, David speaks in such a way as to announce that he cannot say everything on his heart because it's an expression of, it would be an expression that the enemies of God and the enemies of David could take as disloyalty. So in fact, what we have in verses 1 through 3 is a statement of loyalty to God. David begins by showing that though he is really distressed as a result of the difficulties of his life, and though he is going to employ wisdom language, the same kind of language his son will use in Ecclesiastes, and though there'll be a mixture of thanksgiving, this individual lament and this sad reflection, this prayer, is so personally perplexing to David that he says it's dangerous for him to speak these things. David wants to guard his ways, that he might not sin with his tongue. He wants to guard his mouth as with a muzzle because of the presence of the wicked. He speaks of his muteness, of his silence, to refrain from speaking, even from good, and his sorrow growing worse within him. The hotness, the burning of his heart. This is the musing and the fusing and the confusing that Spurgeon spoke of. David is seeking answers to his questions, and it's a sign of great wisdom, and it's something that we can take from verses 1 through 3, is though he is perplexed in the correct direction. He takes his problems, he takes his difficulties, he takes his doubts to God. And there's great wisdom there. Psalm 1 warns us about unwise counselors, about worldly wisdom. And David knows better than that. He wants to guard his thoughts from those who would question his God, and he wants to show his loyalty to God by bringing his problems to God. And that's great wisdom. Though David is at the end of his rope, and some of you, I'm sure, have been in a similar situation describing the severe suffering, whether it's physical or emotional or political. It could have been all three in David's life. This song leads towards a prayer that's spoken to God and against God in brutal honesty. This is the dominant theme as he contrasts speech and silence. And in verses 1 through 3, as we see a silence that David self-imposes on himself because he is so bothered, he's so bugged, he's so tormented by life's difficulties, by what is shown to be, later in the song, the discipline of God. You know, sometimes the only way to avoid sinning with your mouth is by keeping your mouth closed. And this psalm has an increased awareness of the brevity of life and the hard-handed discipline of God, but he refuses to communicate this in a way that would cause the wicked to think that he was disloyal to his God. And so he speaks to his God. And that's the tremendous wisdom of verses 1 through 3. The expression of his loyalty in the same vein as Asaph. I will not cause others to stumble with this. I'm going to take my problems to God. Well, that leads from this first section to the next section. It's a silence that bothered him in verses 1-3, but in verses 4-6, we see him say basically that life is brief. Look at verse 4. Lord, make me to know my end. And what is the extent of my days? Let me know how transient I am. Behold, thou hast made my days as handbreadths, and my lifetime is nothing in thy sight. Surely every man at his best is a mere breath, Selah. Surely every man walks about as a phantom. Surely they make an uproar for nothing. He amasses riches and does not know who will gather them. Various analogies are employed in this second section, but the summary statement is that life is brief. He uses the word breath in verse 5. He'll use it again in verse 11. The Hebrew word chebel, it's translated in the book of Ecclesiastes a great number of times as in vain. Life is a breath, as Solomon will say. Life is in vain, perhaps an expression he learned from his father's song. Ecclesiastes 1, verse 2 speaks of the vanity of life, as does verse 14 in chapter 2. A number of times throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, the same word is used to speak of what one author calls the fatal insufficiency of all that is earthbound. The fatal insufficiency of all that is earthbound. In the oldest song in the Psalter, Psalm 90, written by Moses, the man of God, he speaks similarly. Psalm 90, verse 3 says, thou dost turn man back into dust and dost say, return, O children of men, for 1,000 years in thy sight are like yesterday when it passes by, or as a watch in the night. Thou hast swept them away like a flood. They fall asleep. In the morning, they are like grass which sprouts anew. In the morning, it flourishes and sprouts anew. Toward evening, it fades and withers away. For we've been consumed by thine anger, and by thy wrath, we've been dismayed. Thou hast placed our iniquities before thee, our secret sins in light of thy presence. For all our days have declined in thy fury. We finished our years like a sigh. As for the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to strength, 80 years. Yet their pride is but labor and sorrow, for soon it is gone, and we fly away. Moses, hundreds of years before David ever articulated these things, in his song, wrote the similar concepts. Moses had an awareness, and all people who know God have an awareness of the difference between him and us. This is the fatal insufficiency of all that is earthbound. And the more you know God, the more you become aware of the fragility of our lives. The more you know the eternal God, the more awareness you have of the brevity of our life. It passes by so quickly. Having little kids, people say to me and my lovely wife all the time, this will go by so fast. It doesn't seem like it when they crawl into our bed at 2 a.m. for the third night in a row to persecute me. But I believe that what these friends say is true. It goes by quickly, doesn't it? Those little girls grow up fast. Those little boys become future men and then actual men. And it happens all very quickly. And I think Christians have an awareness of this that transcends the normal worldly understanding of life sure does happen fast, because we have an awareness of the eternal. We know that God goes on, that time presses on according to God's plan. And we have a poignant awareness of that fatal insufficiency of all that is earthbound. And that's why of all the metaphors and analogies that he employs, speaking of the transient nature of our lives, the one that is the most interesting to me is in verse 5. Behold, thou hast made my days as handbreadths. Now, I'm not one to use props in the pulpit more than once in a row. So I'll ask you to take out the prop that I distributed to you. I didn't give it to you. You have it. You've had it your whole life. If you have a hand, will you get it out? Just get it out. Yeah, put it up there. This is the smallest unit of measurement that the Hebrew people used in the old days. It's called a hand breadth. It's about 3 or 4 inches. For me, it's 7. But it's this space. And you could measure a small creature with that, or you could measure a doorpost with that. There's a lot of handy things that you could measure with a hand breadth. It's the smallest unit of measurement. And when David looked at his hand like you just did, he was reminded of that span. So short, so visible. And it reminded him that his life is just like that. It's the shortest possible unit that he could measure. So fleeting, so quick. What a powerful image of the transient nature of our lives. You know, I know how to use the internet, and I looked up what is the smallest unit that we use to measure. And I was really sad that I did, because there's something that scientists use called the Planck length. And I'm positive I'm pronouncing that right. It's 1.6 by 10 to the negative 35th meters across. The Planck length. The explanation I found goes like this. It's equivalent to around a millionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a centimeter across, a decimal point followed by 34 zeros and a one. This is the scale at which quantum foam is believed to exist. The laws of quantum physics cause minute wormholes to open and close constantly, giving space a rapidly changing foam-like structure. At that point, I thought, silly science, and I just turned it off. So whatever your smallest unit of measurement is, and whether you buy into the quantum foam theory, and I reject the quantum foam theory, I just look at my hand and I think, that's how quick life is. It goes by so fast. It's a mere handbreadth. That's what our days are. Our lives are nothing in thy sight, David says. And this isn't just a poignant moment of, Hallmark card kind of issue. This is a dilemma for David. His suffering is going on for too long in his estimation, because he's well aware that life isn't that long. So why is he being oppressed by the discipline of God for such an extended period of time when his whole life is only this big? Craigie says it this way: by beginning to perceive clearly the transitory nature of human existence, the psalmist was also beginning to gain a broader perspective within which to interpret its difficulties and hardships. Value in life and appreciation of life must somehow be grasped within a full knowledge of its transitory nature. And so in verse 5, he uses a strong assertion in Hebrew that occurs as well in verse 6 and verse 11. It's that word, surely, verse 5. Surely every man is at best a mere breath. Verse 6, surely every man walks about as a ghost. Surely they make an uproar for nothing. And then all the way to verse 11, surely every man is a mere breath. This is that same confidence that's expressed famously in Psalm 23, verse 6. Surely I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Except in Psalm 23, verse 6, it's a positive statement. In here, it's an expression of desperation that surely this life is so short, these difficulties are so tangible, that in verse 7, he says, "And now, Lord," this emphatic wording in the original, highlighting that this is where this whole thing is leading up to, calling God master or Lord. "And now, Lord, for what do I wait?" You see, verses 4 through 6 show us that life is indeed brief. And here it's expressed as the dilemma that Ecclesiastes calls vanity. This is the evanescence of life. This is a reminder that the pursuit of wealth, verse 6, the amassing of riches, really is to nothing as well, because once you die, who knows what's going to happen to all that cash? I was mindful of some examples of this brief life that's set before us in this psalm. I remember taking a British literature class in high school and being captivated by the poetry of one of the British romantic poets, George Gordon Byron, famously known as Lord Byron. And he said, "She walks in beauty like the night of cloudless climes and starry skies, and all that's left, all that's best of dark and light meet in her aspect and her eyes." And I, with my teenage angst, I thought, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. If you know anything about his life, he was popular. He was handsome. He was athletic. He was successful. He was excessive. His life was marked by torrid affairs, by illegitimate children, by huge debts. But the guy could write a poem. His life ended in self-imposed exile, and he knew that life was wretched, and he attached himself to fleeting causes, wandering around Europe and the Middle East, got involved with Italian revolutionary politics, which I never advise. And as he joined with the Greeks in the War of Independence from the Turks, he was injured and contracted a fever and died at the age of 36. 3 months before Lord Byron died, he described his life with the word vanity and wrote this line of poetry. "My days are in the yellow leaf. The flowers and fruits of love are gone. The worm, that canker, and the grief are mine alone." What a wasted life. What a brief life by our estimation, comparing him to the oldest people on earth. He didn't live very long, but he had a contemporary, and they definitely did not know each other. One was British, the other one was Scottish. He too wouldn't live very long, dying at the age of 29. He too was born in sin and followed his own pleasures until in his college years he was radically converted and called to ministry. In his lifetime, he was not famous, he was not titled, he was not wealthy. He pastored a little parish in Dundee, Scotland, and he died at age 29 also of a fever. His name was Robert Murray McShane. One of the last entries in his diary in his college days was this: March 29th, 1835, college finished on Friday last, my appearance there. "Life is vanishing fast, make haste for eternity." He too wrote poetry, and his was of greater substance. One song that he composed goes like this: "When this passing world is done, when has sunk yon glaring sun, when we stand with Christ in glory, looking o'er life's finished story, then, Lord, shall I fully know, not till then, how much I owe." Lots of people quote McShane. Few people know what a brief and transient life he had, but what an impact it made as those who did outlive him wrote down the things that he said and the marks of his ministry. He famously said things like, "Live near to God and all things will appear little to you in comparison with eternal realities." McShane was a man who understood how to apply this doctrine of the brevity of life and faith. And when he died at age 29, he understood what Jesus meant when he said, "Soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry." In that little story in Luke 12, "And God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your soul is required of you, and now who will own what you have prepared?" McShane, unlike Lord Byron, understood the words of James 4. "You don't know what your life will be like tomorrow. You're just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, 'If the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that.' But as it is, you boast in your arrogance, and all such boasting is evil." And David got it because he knew no treasure would last. And that's why Jesus said in Matthew 6:19, don't store up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys nor thieves do break in and steal, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. This is how we need to approach God when we're aware that we live in a fallen world and that we're fallen people. But people that know God may have a silence that bothers them, and we all have in common a life that's very brief and fleeting. But now let's look at verses 7 through 11, because we return to that theme of silence in this song. And though we saw in verses 1 through 3 a silence that's bothered, in verses 7 through 11 we see a silence that's believing, a silence that's believing. Look at verse 7. And now, Lord, for what do I wait? My hope is in thee. Deliver me from all my transgressions, verse 8. Make me not the reproach of the foolish. I have become dumb. I do not open my mouth, because it is thou who hast done it. Remove the plague from me because of the opposition of thy hand. I am perishing. With reproofs thou dost chasten a man for iniquity. Thou dost consume as a moth what is precious to him. Surely every man is a mere breath, Selah. It's another cry to silence. Verse 9, I have become dumb. I do not open my mouth. But this one is undergirded, no longer by a fear of the wicked's conception of his disloyalty, but now it is undergirded and led and guided and centered by a robust faith that is an expression of hope in God in spite of his difficulties, in spite of the discipline of God, in spite of his well-known transgressions. Verse 8, he realizes that the only place he can turn, the context being disobedience and sin, the only place he can turn, verse 7, is that his hope is only in God. And so he asks God for rescue, for salvation from transgressions in verse 8. And he's not just concerned with the penalty, though that will come in verse 10. He recognizes that God doesn't take sin lightly. And this is one of the implications of thinking about life as a handbreadth. Why spend your life in sin and excess? Your life is so short. Why not live it with hope in God? To think through the implications of having a short life. People ask this question all the time, don't they? What would you do if you only had a week to live? Poll question. Would you hang glide, ride a bull? Dumb. What would you do if you had a week to live? It should be, especially for a Christian, a sobering question that reminds us that we certainly wouldn't take sin lightly if we had 7 days to live. And David turns this silence from trouble to trusting and expresses his submissive faith here. He says, and now, Lord, calling him Adonai, calling him Lord and Master, an emphatic declaration of hope, a different kind of silence in verse 9 than the silence we met in verses 1 through 3. David had shut his mouth and told himself not to speak out of perceived disloyalty to God, but now he starts to see that God has been working behind the scenes. For those who know God, hope is everything. And so though he stays silent, and though he has questions about God's discipline, and he doesn't understand God's discipline in all its new covenant glory, you know, David didn't have the book of Hebrews yet, but David had sons. David understood the nature of discipline. David understood his own sin. He's confessing it in those verses. And David had sons, and he knew that sons needed the rod of correction. Sons needed to be disciplined and taught and corrected and chastised. And in David's little synopsis, as his faith grows deeper and stronger, we start to see this reality that we understand as New Testament Christians about the discipline of God. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 4 says, in your struggle against sin, you've not yet resisted to the point of shedding your own blood. Have you forgotten the word of encouragement that addresses you as sons? My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline. Do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes everyone he accepts as a son. Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as sons. For what son is not disciplined by his father? If you're not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are illegitimate children and not true sons. The author of Hebrews tries to explain to Christians who are undergoing the consequences and penalties in a temporal sense of their sin and disobedience that God will chastise them. God will discipline them. And David realized that, and it's not incongruous with hope. The confession of his sin, the asking for deliverance of his transgressions, the fear of the penalty, recognizing that God doesn't take sin lightly, he now holds silent because he has a deepened faith and increasing and realized hope that whether God takes this away, this discipline, this difficulty, or whether he does not, he knows that all of this is fleeting and that the transitory nature of life doesn't lead him to depression, but leads him to faith. That's why the image of the moth consuming all things and once again calling man a breath, just a breath. Well, how does this song conclude? Verses 12 through 13, we've seen a silence that bothered in verses 1 through 3, a life that's brief in verses 4 through 6, a silence that's believing in verses 7 through 11. But let's look at this final line of poetry, verses 12 through 13. It's a life that's boundless, a life that's boundless. Look what the verse says. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear to my cry. Do not be silent at my tears, for I am a stranger with thee, a sojourner like all my fathers. Let's deal with just verse 12 to start out. It's a life that's boundless. What does that mean? David has seen the hard discipline of his God, but he refuses to communicate this in a way that would cause the wicked to think he was disloyal to God, and he speaks to God, and this is good. And he's asked God for forgiveness, for salvation from his transgressions, verse 8. And now, as he enters into this final verse of this song, he is giving out a petition of prayer that intensifies in a threefold way. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear to my cry, for do not be silent at my tears. I am a stranger with thee, a sojourner like all my fathers. Here, David calls on his biblical theology, which he would have derived from the Torah and the understanding of a book like Leviticus, a book like Deuteronomy that made provisions for sojourners and aliens who were residents in Israel. Leviticus 25, 23 calls Israelites aliens and tenants in God's land. But God commanded Israel, because they used to be tenants and aliens in Egypt, to remember with a special care those who were sojourners in their own land. So David, in employing this picture of himself as a sojourner, as an alien, one who stays for a little while and one who stays longer, those two words, stranger and sojourner, work like that, were alien residents in a foreign land. And their status was either permanent, they were a foreigner who would stay in Israel, or the latter is a temporary one who would be there for a period of time. Neither person could live in this land without the permission of the inhabitants of the land. And in God's law, in his economy, he had certain protections and rights that he afforded to aliens and strangers, to sojourners. They never had full legal status. They couldn't possess land or buildings, but they were given opportunities and rights. We're reminded of this in the book of Ruth, that the corners of the fields were to be left unharvested so that the widows, the poor, the aliens, and the sojourners could take advantage of those leftover bits of grain in their gleaning so that they would have been provided for in sort of an ancient welfare system. So why bring up these two words, David? Why is verse 12 seeking to deepen this prayer for God to hear him, that God wouldn't be silent like David is at his tears? So David calls on God and identifies himself as a stranger with thee, a sojourner like all my fathers. Well, I think in part he is identifying himself like Israel did. Israel understood that they were merely inhabitants of a land that belonged to God. But I think there's more there than that. This is an appeal to God to hear the psalmist's cry. But it's an appeal wet with tears because David is aware, because of the brevity of his life, because of his own personal eschatology, he is aware that he is merely a passing guest. He's merely a resident alien in this world. That compared to God, he is only here on this planet for a few years, and then he's destined to depart and cease to be. That he can never really own anything, but that he's only at the kindness of the one at whose land he inhabits. David is God's guest. David is God's alien resident. And so he describes himself that way because that passing guest or stranger had a recognized place in Hebrew society, had rights that needed to be safeguarded, and David wants to identify himself in that same category to underline and amplify the transitory nature of his life in this world and his utter and complete dependence on Yahweh's kindness. Now add verse 13 to the mix. And this may seem like a strange ending to you. Turn thy gaze away from me, David says to God, that I may smile again. Before I depart, there's that same sojourner alien word, and am no more. That metaphor of him as a foreigner in a foreign land now takes on another level because he thinks of his departure and his death. And so he ends this prayer with a genuine request that the discipline that God has put on his life, whatever it might be, would go away so that he could die in peace. Verse 13, the way I read it, is not closure. But as one author said, closure has its liabilities. Often in life, our deepest perplexities will not be completely resolved. There will be prayers that you do not receive the answer that you wanted. There will be circumstances that we will face, trials, discipline of God in our lives that we will not understand why we had to endure it for as long as we did. And we may request, like David, that God would remove that chastisement from us. And I don't think we see perfection in verse 13, but I think in this song we've seen progress. And that's a true mark of God's people, isn't it? David recognizes that he's a stranger, an alien, and he knows that there's more difficulty to come. And the bewilderment of a song like this is David only had a faint shadow of how God would fulfill the covenant that he would give to David. And friend, we know so much more than David did because we know the word has become flesh. And we know the gospel, and we see now what David only saw in part, that life and immortality in the gospel is now in all its fullness in Christ Jesus our Lord. It's wise and good for us to look at a song that doesn't end with closure, but ends with a hopeful gaze, verse 7, and an awareness that we are just passing through this world. That makes me want to listen to a whole bunch of sermons this summer on eschatology. I hope it makes you feel that way too. I was reading about Teddy Roosevelt because he's such a man. And I like to read history. And I was looking at pictures on the internet of his famous trip to Africa. You know, after his presidency ended in 1908, he decided not to run again in 09. And instead, he put the blessing on Taft and gave him all the problems. And Roosevelt decided that he would go and man it up in Africa. And he did, a 2,500-mile journey across Africa. And it's really so strange to modern man to hear about something that happened just a little over 100 years ago and how the environmental wackos would have such a hard time with this today. I mean, you think gluten's a problem. Listen to what he did. So he declines running in 1908. He decides to cruise across Africa to go on a specimen journey for the Smithsonian. In this 15-month span, he takes a ship to Africa and he bags 500 big game, 1,000 animals altogether, including 17 lions, 11 bull elephants, and 20 rhinos. I love it. When the end of this trip came about, his return to America was greatly anticipated. He was a very popular president, and they wanted him to run again. And so the New York Daily Tribune on Sunday, June 12, 1910, had the headline and a whole front page spread saying, "Now to welcome Roosevelt home in earnest." Similarly, the Times Dispatch of Richmond, Virginia on the same day said, "Home again." The next day, "Home again. Roosevelt gets a welcome never afforded an American." Thousands of people gathered at the dock to welcome him back from this expedition to kill creatures and stuff them and salt them and put them in the Smithsonian. They probably had to send those back to Africa now in the modern age, but thousands of people clamoring, welcoming him, signs and dignitaries. Well, I remember hearing a story about a husband and wife who were retiring missionaries from Africa who returned on that same ship, returning home not after 15 months, but after many decades of service for the gospel. And Roosevelt comes off the ship to bands and dignitaries and crowds of adoring people. And this missionary couple received no welcoming party. Not one person was there to meet them. The husband was discouraged, and he said something like, "I don't want a parade, but at least someone could have come to welcome us home." And with that, his wife, a wise woman, undoubtedly reminded him, "Honey, we're not home yet." She understood what David is saying here. We are merely sojourners in this brief and fleeting life, as we walk on this earth in our mortal flesh, in our struggle with sin, we sing songs like Psalm 39, because it's a song of a God-fearing man who's experienced the discipline of God and the hardships of life and recognizes the frailty of this life and does it all in the context of prayer to God, of crying out to the God that we can find answers to our complaints, answers to our requests. And as we consider the brevity of life, it leads us, like David, to confession, an awareness of the transitory nature of our lives that makes us stretch our necks towards eternity and say, "I know this life is very short, so why don't we spend some time this summer? Why don't we spend some time personally in our devotional life in God's word, looking forward to that eternal significance that we will experience that will far outlast this brief, fleeting life here on earth. Father, thank you for your word. It has a way of reorienting our thinking, of reminding us what really matters. And we've been confronted with the reality that life is brief and life is hard and judgment is real and the future is certain and earthly things are insufficient. Press those things upon our heart, O God. Change our expectations. Deepen our trust. Make our hope fixed on you, O God, our judge, our deliverer. Increase our fear of the Lord. Give us a proper perspective of our existence, reminding us that we're pilgrims and sojourners in this world, and that our true and lasting hope is found in God alone. Amen.